Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have Justice Lee Gabriel and Justice Bonnie Sutterith, and I'm Sue Walker. We'll be your panel for today, and we have specially set oral argument in this case, Peterson versus CNC Construction. And I understand you have announced the time you would like to argue, and you are ready to proceed. Our clerk will call the case, please.
May it please the court. Your honors, we're here for four issues. Has the third party plaintiff properly joined the third party defendants? Whether the filing of the motion to sever was timely, whether the appellee's filing to amend petition allows for the issue of venue to due to improper joinder to be raised, and whether the trial court erred in considering the untimely response from the appellee.
I have a question right at the outset. Your notice of appeal stated that this appeal was perfected under 15.003 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and I'm wondering why it's not under 15.062 and whether or not we even have jurisdiction.
Because the appeal is for, the transfer of venue was for joinder, improper joinder.
But you were brought in as third party defendants, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so why doesn't 15.062 govern that? Which is, let me see. Counterclaims, cross claims, and third party claims, which says venue of the main action shall establish venue of a counterclaim, cross claim, or third party claim.
Because, Your Honor, I don't believe we're ever party to the main action. The main action was an oral contract between the original plaintiff and a third-party plaintiff. There has been no facts or evidence that my client, Mr. Ulamide, or Peterson USA, was ever party to the oral contract. It is basically, they brought a separate case and tried to combine it into this case, Your Honor. And I believe that they were joining it as plaintiffs, not as third party.
How do you get an appeal from a wrongful third party joinder under 15.003, which is that's the only provision that allows for an interlocutory appeal, is 15.003, and I'm just not seeing how you fall under that.
I think we fall under it, Your Honor, because first of all, they pled no venue facts that would implead Peterson or Mr. Ulamide into the case.
But 15.003 only applies when there's multiple plaintiffs and intervening plaintiffs, correct?
Correct.
So there's one plaintiff here, and it's a defendant who's brought third-party claims.
I believe he brought it as a plaintiff, Your Honor, not as a third-party claim. For it to be a third-party plaintiff, his claims would have to relate to the original plaintiff or to the original suit. His claims do not relate to the original suit. The original suit is for an oral contract between two parties, not between Mr. Ulamide or Peterson USA. They had no issue or any contact with the original plaintiff, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the appellees would have to show that each defendant is properly and pleaded into the suit and that the court had jurisdiction. The appellees can't do that. We have on file in the record Mr. Peterson's, for himself and for his company's affidavit that they do not reside in Tarrant County. They reside in Collin County and Dallas County, Your Honor. That alone keeps them from independently establishing proper venue over the appellants. You also have the probability of being able to establish under 38, 39, or 40, all of which the appellees cannot prove and cannot show that joinder would be proper under any of those statutes. Your Honor, Your Honors, the appellees filed an amended petition, their third amended petition. In that, they took off all claims that were related to the original plaintiff in the suit and kept just a fraud claim against Ulamati and Pedersen. Well, Your Honor, the problem with that is now you're filing for a tort when you have a contract, which they attached to the back of their amended petition. You remove all claims to it. Before anything else was filed by the appellants, we filed the motion for transfer of the, for sever of the case and transfer to appropriate county. I think the case law is clear in the fact that when you file, when you amend your petition, then the other party has a chance to amend their answers and any other previous documents that were related to that petition, and which is, in this case, is which what we did. Before we filed anything else, we filed a motion to transfer and sever.
But you already filed an answer, correct?
But that answer was to the original petition filed by the plaintiffs.
Is it your position that every time a pleading is amended by your, a plaintiff's pleading is amended, that that could give rise then to another motion to change venue?
Not in every instances, Your Honor, but when they were stripped everything out that got into the case, got the plaintiffs into the case.
But is it your position that if things change and something new is alleged or somebody else is added or something, every time that a plaintiff should amend their petition and something like that changes, that negates the due order of pleadings rule and you're open to challenge venue?
Your Honor, I think Watson versus the City of Odessa addresses that issue. In there, the court held that when Watson, I believe, filed its amended petition, that Odessa could have filed an amended motion to transfer. If they can file an amended motion to transfer when the petition has been changed, why wouldn't I be able now to file a motion to transfer? So I believe that you are.
Probably they filed their initial motion to transfer before they filed an answer.
But still being the case, they still filed. They were still allowed to file an amended motion after they've already filed. They filed the answer.
Did it relate back to the original?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor, when it's a new petition, because you're basing it off of the live petition. The live petition now.
I'm talking about the motion to transfer venue. Their amended motion to transfer venue related back to their original motion to transfer venue, which I bet was filed before they filed an answer.
I believe it was filed before they filed the answer, but they never filed one. The court brought that to their attention. They could have filed one. And then again, you still have every court said that the live petition is what matters. The live petition was his amended petition, not the original petition. So we are filing this based off his live petition. If that's the case, then why have venue rules at all? Because then all I've got to do is go file enough facts to get venue, then go change it to wherever is really the case going on, and now I've got someone stuck in a jurisdiction they don't belong. That would negate the whole purpose of the venue rule, I believe. And finally, and Your Honors, I would like to bring up my fourth point is whether the trial court erred in considering the untimely response of the appellee. The trial court repeatedly has been on the appellee's counsel for failing to file replies to any motion for 3 years. And the case law is clear. A motion to transfer venue is going to be heard on the pleadings that are live at the time, any stipulations between the parties, and affidavits. The pleadings that were live at the time of the hearing were the third party plaintiff's motion or amended petition, the appellant's motion to transfer and sever venue for improper joinder. There was no stipulations between the parties, and only affidavits on file were those that were attached to the motion to transfer by the appellants. That's all that should have been considered. The fact that he was allowed they can use his reply to consider that in itself should void the ruling. Because if you look at just what was on file, there are no facts. That's his live petition. And as the courts have repeatedly stated, whatever is included in your live petition is what's in there. So if you change your petition and you leave out venue facts, that doesn't carry over. It's only your live petition. There are no venue facts in his live petition, Third Amendment claim petition. So the court should have looked at just the pleadings, which is the motion to transfer, stipulations between the parties and affidavits. Those are the only things that should have been considered in that motion. And if those are the only things that's considered in that motion, then the only one way for the court to have ruled, and that was to grant the motion. The fact that the court allowed the appellees to reply, one, goes against the rule. It's Texas Civil Practice and Remedy Code 86 or 87 does not require a response for a motion to transfer venue. That's all I have, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Gray Pearson for the appellee. I'll try to keep it fairly short. Pedersen and Uyamati are essentially supposed loan brokers, but they don't actually provide loans. It's our position they are fraudulent. My client, or clients, were looking for a loan. They were very naive. They were told that these people could provide them with great big loan, and they went looking for this loan. They were told that to get the loan, you had to pay money up front to get this fast loan. And they were told first it was going to be $67,500, but no, they'd take $50,000. So they got the money together. Part of the money came from this man, Mr. DeRogatis. He put up $25,000. Another $25,000 came from CNC, one of my clients. They gave the money. No loan. It never was going to be a loan. So Mr. DeRogatis wanted his money back. The money didn't come back. So he sued CNC because he had given his money to CNC, which consolidated the money and gave it over to Pedersen Uyamati. If you look at his petition, which I believe I attached to our appendix, all the way through he talks about Pedersen, because that's who got the money. That's who kept the money wrongfully. When I got involved in it, I looked at it. I said, looks like Pedersen's the wrongdoer here, and Uyamati. So I wanted to take the deposition of Uyamati. He resisted. I finally did take Mr. Uyamati's deposition. And right before it, they tried to block the deposition. And at that hearing, the judge said, well, are you going to try to bring him in? I said, I think so. He said, okay, well, bring him in before this date. Otherwise, the trial needs to go forward. But if you bring him in, I'm going to delay the trial. So as the judge requested, I brought him in. They responded when they filed their answer with a plea to jurisdiction, but there was no motion to transfer venue. They did not file a motion to transfer venue for another 18 months. This argument somehow, well, first off, on the issue of joinder, they argued the issue of joinder in the trial court. It was rejected. They filed a petition for writ of mandamus in this court. It was rejected. They filed a case in the Dallas court, I think the 298th, or no, it wasn't that one, 68th court in Dallas. Between the time of the deposition and the time I filed the suit here and the 48th court, the third party action, trying to think somehow that would fix it. Of course, it wouldn't, because the DeRogatis case had been filed like a year and a half earlier. The Dallas court looked at the situation, and same argument was made, and it said, no, Fort Worth has dominant jurisdiction. It was filed first. Dallas abated. That's been heard repeatedly. Regarding the severance argument, well, the severance issue is moot. We settled our issue with Mr. DeRogatis. That's over. With respect to the notion that it's a contract claim on our part, no, it's not. It's a fraud claim. There was a contract involved, but the whole thing was fraudulent. In fact, they produced contracts that my client never signed, and they've changed out the second page to make it say things it didn't say, or rather the first page. But on the venue issue, they skirted the issue right and left, but it's our understanding, and we present it to the court, that motions to transfer venue must be filed before or with an original answer or they're waived. In this case, it wasn't, and our position is appellants waive their right to challenge venue.
How do you explain the Watson case if it says what your opposing counsel says it says?
Well, it would be my position, without, I think I've glanced at it, that they still filed their motion for transfer venue on time. I don't think there's a case out there, Justice Sutter, where a party failed to file a motion to transfer venue either before or with the original answer. And then later on, after there was some amended pleading, then filed it, and the court said, that's okay. If there is, I must confess I didn't find it. And I certainly looked.
So that distinguishes it in your mind?
I think it does.
Okay.
If there's such a case, I didn't find it.
Do you think this is the proper appeal under 15.003?
I do not. But that's for this court to determine, not for me. Thank you.
You have more time. Your time's not up.
No, I know it's, for those of you who know me, it's a surprise that I'm not up here saying a lot more. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Davis, you have a rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
I just want to rebuttal a couple of points. First of all, Mr. Pearson used the check paid by Derogatis to CNC Construction as proof that the cases are related. Mr. Derogatis paid with a personal check. CNC paid Pedersen USA with a cashier's check on the same day. Personal check for $25,000 at a different bank is not getting cleared the same day. So the transactions, under no rule of law, were those two transactions the same. You couldn't bring it in under UCC, wouldn't consider them the same transaction, and you couldn't bring them under general contract law. Your Honor, Mr. Garrett Pearson wants to talk about waiting to bring a motion. He waited for 2 years before he tried to plead my clients. We're not here to discuss the fact that I don't even think it was proper for the court to allow him to plead them in the first place, 30 days before trial. But the problem with that argument is we didn't wait. We filed an abatement. We did not file a venue, because the way I read the law is Lee versus GSC Transportation Systems, and the 10 times that it's been brought in front of appellate courts over the last 8 years, states that a third party being deposed does not make them a party to a suit. So after we got, before my client was even deposed, we filed suit against CNC in Dallas court. That made ours the dominant case and made Dallas the dominant jurisdiction. Regardless of any outcome, there are 10 cases that appellate courts in Texas have held that deposing someone who's not party to the case does not bring them into the suit, does not make them party to the suit. You even have a federal Fifth Circuit where they held the same thing, that does not make the person a party to the suit. So if Mr. Pearson wants to get into a discussion of that, that doesn't matter to this case. The case is, were we properly joined? No, we weren't. He's mentioned nothing to show that how we were properly joined, my clients were properly joined to the suit. And again, just to close on it, we filed an abatement. We didn't file anything because, in my view, the abatement was the proper vehicle to file at the time. From the case law that I've studied, a deposition didn't make us part of the suit. So therefore, when we filed suit before the deposition in Dallas County, that's where the case should remain. That's it, Your Honors.
Davis? Gentlemen, thank you for your arguments presented to the court today. They've been helpful, and your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, and our clerk will adjourn court.
All rise.